On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Cloudflare leaked all over the internet, but this could actually be a good thing. Plus, Esri is here to tell you everything you need to know about location-based services. It's Wyatt on the set. Cloudflare!
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 228, recorded February 24, 2017, ArcGIS Insights by Esri. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Jamf. With more than 10,000 customers, Jamf provides Apple management software for Mac, iPad, and iPhone devices in the enterprise. The robust software enables IT professionals to automate time-consuming tasks and reduce help desk tickets. Go to jamf.com/enterprise to see how Jamf can help your organization succeed with Apple. And by Amazon Web Services. For companies to succeed today, they need a range of tools that most cloud vendors just don't offer. Amazon Web Services, the leading cloud service provider, listens to builders, offering more solutions than any other cloud provider. Check out podcasts at AWS and see how AWS lets builders build. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise, but I can't guide you by myself. For that, I'm going to need the help of my friends, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. That's right. He is our expert over on the right coast. Curtis, how are you? And by the way, sir, you're looking very clear today.
Thank you, Padre. It's amazing what a nice new camera will do for clarity. But aside from the clarity, it's just another beautiful day here in the swamp.
Indeed, in the swamp. Also on the other swamp, the tropical swamp, is our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. He's the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, are the waves treating your packets well?
They're doing fine, actually. We've been downstairs at the video wall watching the ROV from the Okeanos Explorer looking at the reefs and seamounts around American Samoa. Very cool stuff. And to our viewers, I want to remind them that Leo is asking us very kindly to go and do a survey. So that's twit.tv/survey. Be there, be square. Thank you.
And, of course, Chibert did that because he is the producer of TWiT, and he knows I always forget to say that. Thank you very much, Chibert. Now, gentlemen, we've got a packed show. Not only do we have Esri coming on to, well, just fill us in on that particularly growing part of the enterprise, but we're also going to cover a very current event. We've got an issue going on with some data breach, but let's go ahead and jump straight into the blips. Speaking of that breach, let's talk about Cloudflare. Now, Cloudflare, that's the web services and security giant out of San Francisco that made its bones by mitigating before unheard of 400 and 500 gigabit per second DDoS attacks back in 2014. They suffered a security embarrassment when its servers started leaking out private client data, including cookies and authentication tokens. The memory leak, spotted by Travis Ormandy working on behalf of Google's Project Zero, was caused by a buffer overrun susceptibility, which ironically was triggered by a single line of code that was supposed to prevent buffer overruns. Cloudflare, using Ragel as their parser, generated C code that used an equality operator instead of a greater than equal to operator. This created a bug that allowed the pointer to jump over the equality operator and therefore pass the buffer overrun check. It should be noted that this wasn't a bug in Cloudflare's code or in Ragel, but in the way that Ragel was used to generate the C code. With this bug in place, Cloudflare's CDN services served out bits and blogs of private customer data that unfortunately ended up being cached by Google servers. Once informed, Cloudflare immediately disabled the affected services till patched and worked with Google to clear those caches. The code in question has been in place since September 22nd of last year, but the biggest impact occurred between February 13th and 18th, when about 120,000 pages leaked each day. No SSL keys were compromised, and Cloudflare is being as transparent as possible to mitigate the security exposure.
Speaking of the cloud, HPE had a stormy year in the cloud. Seems that pretty much every company out there is seeing profit in the cloud, unless, of course, that company is named HPE. On Thursday, HPE reported quarterly net revenue of $11.4 billion, down 10% year over year. CEO Meg Whitman described the result for the first quarter, which ended January 31st, as mixed on a conference call with analysts. While revenue was bad, earnings per share were good, showing 16 cents per share, well ahead of the outlook numbers of 3 to 7 cents per share. Now, Whitman cited an array of problems, she referred to unexpected headwinds, as leading to the company's financial woes. HPE was hurt by significantly reduced demand from a single Tier 1 service provider customer, Whitman said. The company was beset with execution problems, which Whitman took responsibility for, including upper management organizational changes. Now, though, HPE is focusing on its priorities: hybrid IT, intelligence, edge, and services. HPE has seen strong growth in higher margin, higher performance computing, including the product line from SGI, which HPE acquired last year, as well as mission critical systems, and upcoming changes are anticipated to mitigate the decline.
Google's security princess, and why we really need more equality in the IT world. Parisa Tabriz is the company's ace up the sleeve, a young professional hacker they call their security princess. As a white hat hacker, the Polish-Iranian American is paid to attack her own employer so that the bad guys, aka black hat, don't get there first. So this is actually a message for my female students. This just illustrates that this is still a great industry that's rewarding talent regardless of your sex, mostly. So I offer the same advice I give to my female students. Consider joining the Women in Technology, aka WITI, W-I-T-I, to help make sure the playing field gets leveled.
Hey, if you're a network engineer running out of fiber capacity, your options can be, well, a little bit limited. You could run new fiber or upgrade your switches and transceivers to get slightly more bandwidth, or go with WDM, wavelength division multiplexing gear that can use multiple simultaneous carrier signals. But an Ohio-based company has a new option for you. Double what you already have. Champion One, which has been around for about 2 decades, has introduced a new line of SFP, SFP Plus, and XFP transceivers that can do with a single strand of fiber what traditional transceivers do with two. Their units can shoot between 2 and 120 kilometers between repeaters and supports everything from 125 megabit per second fast Ethernet to 2.488 gigabit per second OC48s to 10 gig Ethernet. Combined with WDM, a single fiber link can now be turned into 80.
There's a new home for Ruckus, but is it the best fit? Just as wireless LAN infrastructure company Ruckus was getting comfortable being part of Brocade, well, it's time to pull up stakes and order some new business cards. Aris Group, maker of infrastructure products for the cable and telecom industries, has purchased Ruckus for around $800 million. Aris has been on something of a buying spree of late, swallowing Motorola Home in 2013 and Pace in 2016. Why Ruckus? Well, in a written statement, Aris CEO Bruce McClellan said, quote, "It's our view that the industry is going to evolve a lot and transform over the next 3 to 5 years, and ultimately everyone becomes a wireless or mobile operator in some form or fashion," end quote. Particularly interesting from a technology perspective is the development work that Ruckus has done around neutral host LTE infrastructure. You see, Ruckus is creating small cells that operate across multiple spectrum bands, so a single piece of hardware can extend indoor cellular connectivity for customers getting service from all the major wireless carriers. Ruckus also brings with it new access to major enterprise customers in the hospitality, education, sports and entertainment, retail, warehousing, transportation, and smart cities arenas. According to McClellan, one of the first moves Aris is considering is taking the Ruckus Wi-Fi magic sauce and integrate it into existing Aris customer premises equipment. Those are the sorts of things that you're likely to have from your cable company for your cable internet. Products like the wireless gateways and set-tops that Aris sells to those service providers. However, McClellan also wants to use Ruckus's expertise to build new wireless capabilities into Aris's fiber infrastructure products.
Qualcomm's new Snapdragon X16 and X20 will make it easier to actually reach gigabit download speeds. Of note, the Snapdragon X20 LTE modem is an LTE Advanced Pro modem that supports Licensed Assisted Access, or LAA, the global standard for LTE in unlicensed spectrum. Support for both 5XCA and LAA is significant because it allows operators to launch gigabit LTE service with as little as 10 megahertz of licensed spectrum, which vastly expands the number of operators who can offer gigabit LTE service around the globe. Additionally, the Snapdragon X20 LTE modem supports the 3.5 gigahertz shared spectrum in the U.S. called Citizens Broadband Radio Service, or CBRS, which can be used to provide new services such as private LTE-based networks. It can also be used by existing mobile operators to offer gigabit LTE in more places by making more spectrum available. What's really significant is that Intel is snapping at Qualcomm's heels with the XMM7560 modem that is being touted as being able to offer similar performance specifications. In other words, wahoo, more speed!
Now, Verizon's Data Breach Digest of 2017 had an interesting case study from an unspecified university in which the network was DDoSed by the network. That in itself isn't news, but what is news is the fact that this DDoS was caused by all the network's IoT devices. At some point in 2016, over 5,000 devices were hacked and turned into zombie nodes that attacked the network to which they were attached. But there's more. The nodes that were exploited were Internet of Things devices such as refrigerators, vending machines, and network-connected lights. In the analysis of the attack, researchers discovered that the devices had been exploited to send a flood of DNS requests for a local seafood restaurant every 15 minutes. Now, this seems to point towards a research project gone wrong, but even if it wasn't malicious, it could easily have been, as with the takedown of Akamai. Just another example of IoT done wrong. That does it for the blips. Next up comes the bites. We're going to have to jump a little bit more into that Cloudflare breach because it is a very interesting case study of both how things go wrong and how things go very, very right. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you by Jamf. It's a mobile device management suite that enables over 10,000 global customers to manage more than 7 million Apple devices. Jamf's Enterprise Mobility Management solution helps IT provide the user-friendly experience that employees expect from their Apple devices while empowering them to focus on their goals and not their tech. Now, if you've ever had to create a device management policy that lets your users keep their favorite devices while also having access to corporate resources, then you're exactly the person that Jamf was made for. Jamf Pro lets you deploy devices without physically touching them, automate device status and updates, and keep inventory data of hardware and software, all while ensuring device security. It offers a customizable enterprise app store, which allows your users to install apps and update software themselves without your intervention. Go figure. All without putting your security policies at risk. These features, reinforced by world-class support and training, make Jamf the best solution for managing Apple. Learn about it from companies that have benefited from Jamf. In 2015, IBM gave its employees the choice to use PC or Mac in the workplace, and many of them chose to use Mac. Now, to handle the high demand, IBM utilized Jamf Pro to deploy the preferred tech quickly. In just over a year, the company has expanded its choice program to support more than 90,000 Macs, making IBM the largest Mac deployment on Earth. What's interesting is that IBM only has 5 IT admins supporting Mac, all thanks to Jamf Pro. You can even integrate Jamf Pro with existing IT services and technologies like the Apple Device Enrollment Program, the Volume Purchase Program, and the Apple School Manager, and more. Jamf Pro is available in the cloud or on-premise for those who like to keep it old school. You know, if you really want a turnkey solution, you can leave your Apple Mobile Device Management MDM infrastructure to them by subscribing to Jamf Pro for a hosted solution. Folks, why do you want to make it so hard for yourself? From its world-class support to its premium services and training courses, Jamf has everything enterprise organizations need to ensure their Apple implementation is a long-lasting success. It's about time that IT got some love. Go to jamf.com/enterprise. That's jamf.com/enterprise to discover how Jamf makes life easier for IT and its users. Request a free trial of the robust Jamf Pro solution today to see what you've been missing. That's Jamf, J-A-M-F.com/enterprise. And we thank Jeff for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and jump into the bite. And we got to backtrack a little bit to that blip, because that blip, that first blip, gave you a quick look into what's going on right now. Cloudflare is all over the internet. It's all over Twitter. It's all over Facebook. People are talking about this because, well, it's big. They host thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of websites, and all of them have been affected by what, by all accounts, was just a mistake of coding. Now, let's take a look at exactly what happened. If you go here, this is the root cause of the bug. This one line. It's an if statement. If plus PP is equal to PE, go to underscore test underscore EOF, end of file. It looks really innocuous, but the problem is this line of code was supposed to let the program know if the pointer was going beyond the point at which it was supposed to go. In other words, the pointer was only supposed to look at the data, the memory cells that it was supposed to have access to. Unfortunately, that double equal, the equality operator, it wasn't supposed to be an equality operator. It was supposed to be a greater than. So in other words, if the pointer goes beyond the point at which it's supposed to end, then stop doing what you're doing. The way it's written here is if and only if the pointer is exactly equal to the end of that set of memory cells, then stop what you're doing. Most of the time, however, the pointer jumped over the equality operator, which meant that you could start writing memory cells that weren't supposed to be written out to your services. Now, all of this is a long way of saying that Cloudflare started publishing little bits and pieces, random bits of data that were cached by Google servers, which could be searched for. Now, that's a kind of a technical way of saying, oops. But here's the thing, and Chibert, I want to bring you in on this. This wasn't an error of coding. Cloudflare actually did the right thing. Their engineers did the right thing. They wrote it properly, but then they used Ragel, which is a parser, to convert their script into C code, which was then implemented on their services. They didn't use it properly. And they even admit that they didn't use it properly, and they didn't check that equality operator later on. And when Ragel did the parsing, when it did the coding, it changed the greater than to the equality operator, and that's what's caused all the problem. That wasn't a problem. It wasn't an error with Ragel. It wasn't even really an error with the Cloudflare code. It was just a simple oversight when they were doing their checking. Chibert, we're going to see more and more of this because we have some incredibly popular software suites out there that make it very easy for you to code once and then transcode multiple times. This, however, shows you that even after you use one of these great suites, you still kind of double check, triple check, and quadruple check the code, especially for something as important as buffer overflow checking. What's your take on this?
Well, my take on this is I got a really strong case of deja vu. There was, back in the 1950s, a case where actually it was the Air Force, had to destroy an Atlas II rocket because a programmer forgot a semicolon at the end of a line. And so it basically just kept going instead of going to a new line, and the rocket started going, well, off track, and they had to blow it up. This is really a problem, and it's happened time and time again. And I will say the Air Force project had many, many layers of quality checking, but we're human. And I don't know how to solve this yet. This is a really big computer science issue. It's gone up with, we've talked about it a lot in all kinds of symposia with computer scientists, and there's still not a really good way, especially when you're translating between languages that or platforms that are radically different. Especially if you're going from, say, Python into C, or a lot of scientists are using MATLAB and then using the compiler to compile it into C code. Sometimes you miss it, and we're only human, and oh my God, oh, I feel so bad for these guys.
I know, I do, because again, I would actually think they deserved it if they had not put in buffer overflow checking, but they did. They tried to, and it didn't code over properly. But there's another issue here, and that is what they did right. So that was what they did wrong. What they did wrong is they didn't check the code once it had gone through Ragel. They didn't make sure that the buffer overflow protection was still enabled. But what they did, and I'm actually very, very encouraged to see this in the enterprise, is they were immediate in their response. So they know that the code was in place. It's September 22nd. It was spotted by, again, Google's open project on February 18th. They responded on February 18th. So right away, they jumped in. They disabled the services that were exposed to this bug. And then they worked with Google to remove all the caching. However, in doing that, they did what Cheebert and I have been talking about for a long time, and that is that they did 100% transparent failure. They let people know immediately on their blog, this is what's happening, this is what we're doing to fix it, this is what it affects. It sounds really simple, but Curtis, let me throw this into you. On the enterprise side, it is very difficult to admit failure. I mean, we can look at Yahoo and say, well, there's a big difference between a few hours of response time and a year of response time. So how do we've talked about this before. How do we point at this and say, look, yes, this was a failure, but this was a good failure. This was a company acting responsibly, and we want to encourage that. We want companies to look at what's happening to Cloudflare and say, I should be responsible like them.
You know, I'm going to draw a parallel to something that happened in another branch of engineering a decade or so ago. There was an issue with one of the skyscrapers in Manhattan or across the river, New York City. I believe it was a Chase Manhattan skyscraper where it was being used after it was up and built. It was being used as an example in an engineering class for a university. And one of the students did some dynamics simulation on it and came back and said, you know, there's a problem with this building. They went back to the engineering firm that had signed off on the original plans and found that, yes, indeed, there were some issues with the building. The engineering firm admitted it, worked with the architect. They went back and did some mitigation. And PBS actually had a special on this showing everything that went on. And a number of people ask, should the engineering firm have been held accountable? And the general feeling within the engineering profession was no, because the system worked very right. And you actually want the people who are doing the work to be encouraged to go back and check their work and respond to problems. If the culture of the organization is that when we see a problem, we kill anyone who is responsible, then no one is encouraged to come forward and try to improve their work. So I think that this is an example of a company doing what it should have done. They're being transparent. They're being very quick to deal with it. And frankly, we should do more of this. It helps deal with some of the issues that that old school programmers say are rife in the agile development methodology, where you don't have the many different iterations of testing. If you're not going to have many iterations of testing before you take code live, then you have to be able to make the changes necessary when real world testing, let's call it what it is, users or researchers finding bugs, dig up those issues and you deal with them. So I think this is actually an example of a company doing what it's supposed to be doing. And I wish many more companies would have a culture that allowed them to follow this example. There are still too many where the penalty for a mistake is much greater than any upside that an employee gets for finding that mistake.
Right. And I'm absolutely with you, Curtis. And Cheebert, I want to bring you in on that. You know, both Curtis and I are on the same page here saying that, yeah, Cloudflare did the right thing. They didn't have to. I mean, they could have been like a Yahoo. They could have been very obtuse. They could have been obstructive to the investigation. They could have basically brushed off the Google people and say, this is a problem on your side, not our side. But no, they owned it. They said, we know where the mistake is. This is exactly the line of code that caused the issue. Now we're working with all parties to make this better. They're getting kicked in the teeth today. I mean, just a quick scan of social media, you've got people swearing at Cloudflare, people who previously didn't even know what Cloudflare was. And I think it sends the wrong message. It sends the wrong that if you are an enterprise that's trying to be responsible, we'll kick you. We'll kick you when you're down. And that does not encourage the transparent failure that we want. So how do we encourage that transparent failure?
Well, we do exactly what we're doing. You know, we sit on social media, we sit on a show and say, hey, Cloudflare, good on ya. You know, coding, you know, especially when you're dealing with really complex systems, you're dealing with systems that could be upwards of a couple million lines of code, especially after it's gone from a very high-level language into a lower-level language like C. You know, this is a lot of things to go wrong, a lot of moving parts. And we're always going to have problems. And my opinion is Cloudflare, you totally did the right thing. I'd love to see transparency. I don't want to see a Sony. I don't want to see a Home Depot. I want to see someone own the problem, work with people to fix it, and maintain transparency. Maybe the U.S. federal government ought to learn this a little bit.
Yeah, well, right now they're kind of working on what their response will be to the cyber. But let's get a bit more practical. For those people who are wondering whether or not your passwords, your credentials were compromised, let me just say, yes, assume it is. Even if you are not using a service that was hosted by Cloudflare, you don't know what dependencies the services that you do use are actually utilizing, which means that your credentials still could have been compromised. I think this is a good time since we've got at least top 10,000 sites that were compromised by this little breach for you to change all your credentials across the board. It's just really good practice. Unfortunately, we're going to see more and more of these things where it's not just a brand name like a Yahoo or a Verizon or an Apple that get breached. It's now the backend provider, because that's our model now, right? Everything goes in the cloud. A single provider can serve out to thousands, tens of thousands of clients. And if there is a mistake of this magnitude where random bits of memory were leaked out into the cloud, you'll never really know, and you can never really guarantee that your current credentials are safe. So my advice would be you change everything. Today is the day where you go down your list and everything gets changed. Chibert, would you do that, or am I being too paranoid?
No, actually, I've already started. I've got a password vault, and I'm actually going through and starting to change my passwords. I'm prioritizing anything that's got multi-factor authentication. I'm leaving to later because I've literally got hundreds of passwords to change. But yeah, I've already started changing, and anything that has multi-factor now that didn't when I first set it up is getting multi-factor now.
Yeah, that's it. What about you, Curtis? I mean, I know you've been relying on your very strong password 1234 for years, but is this now the time to maybe dump that?
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go to the much stronger ABCD. I said that out loud, didn't I?
That's okay. Just make the E into the number 3. No one ever figures that out.
Wow. See, there we go. This is the kind of practical information that people expect from Twyatt. I'm going to be doing some changing. And I have to say that this is one of those times when the cloud giveth and the cloud taketh away, because, you know, in my case, there are any number of services now and websites for that matter where doing the change means not only changing them on the basic service, but going ahead and making the change to be reflected on my laptop computer, on my phone, on my tablet. It's amazing how far-reaching these changes are. And I think this is just one more example that shows us why we really need to move beyond the password when it comes to security. Do I know for sure what's next? No. But we need to move beyond the password, and I'm grateful for each and every one of the two-factor authentication schemes I have in place.
All right, gentlemen, we need to move on. I think the parting shot for that would just be to say that, yes, this actually is a very involved error. This is a significant bug. This is a significant leak of private data. However, as we've all said, Cloudflare, good on you. Sorry that you didn't check your code, but thank you very much for at least giving us a little bit of what it means to be a responsible member of the enterprise. We are going to move on, and we're going to be bringing in Esri. Folks, if you've ever wanted to know about how you're going to use their services to make your enterprise better, you're going to want to stay tabbed. But first, let's take another moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And, of course, it's got to be AWS, Amazon Web Services. Now, AWS provides a robust and scalable platform to help builders of any type and any size innovate quickly. With twice the compliance certifications and the largest global footprint of any other cloud vendor, AWS does all the heavy lifting of IT infrastructure management so that builders like you can focus on what you do best, not building out the network, but building product. AWS provides the most comprehensive set of features for builders, releasing new features at a faster rate than anybody else, with over 1,000 new features in 2016 alone. Services support virtually any cloud workload with more than 70 services that range from compute, storage, networking, database, analytics, application services, deployment management, and mobile. By listening to builders' wants, AWS has been able to add more capabilities than any other cloud provider, and the capabilities that you've actually asked for. AWS storage solutions are designed to deliver secure, scalable, and durable storage for businesses looking to achieve efficiency and scalability within their backup and recovery environments without the need for an on-premise infrastructure. It offers the widest global reach of any cloud provider and allows you to choose in which region your data resides. That's important in this day and age. Now, that will help you minimize latency and costs as well as address regulatory requirements. You have complete control of your data, just the way it should be. With AWS, startups can scale like enterprises, and enterprises can be nimble like startups. Now, whether you are new to AWS or have experience with AWS, they want to provide the right resources to support your success and help you do amazing things. Learn more at podcast.aws. That's podcast.aws. And we thank Amazon Web Services for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's time for my favorite bit of the show, and that's when we bring in outside experts to help us, well, define exactly what's going on in the enterprise. We welcome to the show Art Haddad. He's the CTO and location analytics, and Linda Beal, a lead product engineer. Thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks for having us on, Father. Appreciate it.
And Linda, I know you're sitting back there. You're going to do the demo for us, but we got to see you at least once. Can you say hi to the Twilight, right?
Hi.
When you see all the cool stuff happening, it's her that's doing it. Now, yep. Art, let's start with you. Exactly what is ArcGIS? What do you do?
Well, Esri is a enterprise software company that focuses on GIS technology. GIS being geographic information systems, maps, spatial analysis, things of that nature. So ArcGIS is the system from which we build and expose capabilities of the GIS technology to our users that pretty much create the maps that run the world. You can think about it that way.
Okay. And why Esri? I mean, Esri got into this business and they thought there's not enough being done for location-aware, location-based services. What's the founding principle of Esri? What did you come in to change in this field?
Well, Esri was founded back in 1969 by Jack and Laura Dangerman. Pretty much the parents of GIS itself. And they look to make a difference in the world through the use of the science of geography and the technology of GIS. Something they're trying to, that Esri is trying to put together, what we call the science of where. It enables the use of the location element, the place, the where, the why, the when, the how, based on the geographic capabilities around you.
And of course, when we think of GIS, I mean, this was the original big data way back when, many decades ago, before big data became big data. I mean, this was the data set that you absolutely could draw correlations from, and that's what you do. But let me ask you, I think our audience has a pretty good notion of where this would be useful and why you'd want it. But what would be your elevator pitch? Let's say you're speaking to the CTO or the CEO of a 10,000-seat enterprise that provides X services. What would be your pitch as to what location-aware services could do for them?
That's a very good question. And not being in sales, I'd have a conversation to a CTO or a CIO or even a CEO as if you really want to take advantage of understanding the data, understanding what you can do with that data and all the things around it. ArcGIS is that thing. As a matter of fact, one of the things we're going to show you is insights for ArcGIS. It's that spatial analytics capability that enables almost anyone to take advantage of the spatial component of your data and perform analysis with it to discover the meaning of what that data is trying to tell you.
Well, what kind of insights can I glean? I like the service. Insights as a service is fantastic. But, right. I mean, what we're going to see it in the demo in just a bit, but right. Sort of high level here, what can I expect? What kind of correlations will I be able to draw from this data set?
Well, the first thing I just want to point out, it's not just about a map. It's what you can do with what you see on the map, right? A lot of folks want to add a map to their dashboard or add a map to their the report or whatever so they can kind of see the things around what they're looking at, the total sales by customer or whatever it may be. But could you imagine you're trying to put together a service-level agreement based on your current location? And what you basically say is it's 30 minutes or less for the service or, you know, in terms of a drive, customer repair kind of a scenario, or it's free. So what do? They put their location on the map. They use an address matching capability, what we call geocoding, and then they draw a circle around it as a crow flies, you know, 30-minute window, Euclidean distance, if you will. And then they say, okay, everything in here is 30 minutes or less, and we'll support that. Well, what they ended up doing was losing millions of dollars in their first year because they forgot to take into account the location, the geography, the where. And so bringing in a GIS person, you would say, okay, well, what about the street network? What about the waterways? What about the construction? What about the different times of day and traffic? And so changing that from a point in distance to a drive time analysis, they quickly discovered that their 30-minute window was nowhere near what they had drawn out just by using a point in distance. So you can imagine the power of what location can deliver just by taking advantage of that coordinate and the drive time and, of course, all the ancillary layers around it.
All right, let's jump straight into it because our audience, hopefully they're salivating a little bit because you've given them a lot of promise, a lot of possibility. Yeah. Let's actually show them what you can do. Run your demo.
There you go. Linda, take it away.
Okay. Can you see the screen okay?
We got it.
Okay. So let me introduce you to Insights for ArcGIS. So we work with workbooks, pages, and cards within it. So I'm going to start up a workbook that I have here. Obviously, the first thing we need to do before we can do any exploring and analyzing of our data is add in our data. So here we have the data that we can add from our enterprise. So this is my own personal data here. So we're actually going to be looking at crimes across Philadelphia. So I've added in that data. But just to go through where we can get the data from, I can add it in from my larger organization. I can also add in data directly from Excel. So I'm going to add in something there. And also we can connect directly into databases. So we can connect directly to SAP HANA, Teradata, or SQL servers. So let's add in those two different layers that I brought in. You'll see the spatial data that we had, so those crime incidents across Philadelphia, are immediately mapped on one of our cards. And the other data that I brought in from Excel, you see we have the option to create a chart or show a table with that. So I can bring in that data, I can create that chart, I can create a table. So you can see now we can start working with data. So even though this is GIS, we're going to do some spatial analysis in a minute. It's not just about spatial data. We can work with spatial and non-spatial data together. So let's get rid of the data we have there. We're just going to focus in on these crime incidents. So you'll see what we do is we also expose all of the information that sits behind where these locations are. So we're actually interrogating that data when it comes in. We can tell you immediately just by you looking at this, whether it has a spatial component, whether it has a numeric categorical, time. So we're seeing all of the features within that data. So you can start to actually interrogate that data and really ask questions of each of the pieces of information that you have within that data. So one of the key concepts that we have within Insights for ArcGIS is that you should actually be working directly with this data. So let's take something like the crime type. What I'm going to do is just drag that across. So if you can see something, you should be able to do it, do something with that item. So by dragging that crime type across, you'll see that that's now mapped, visualized, showing that different crime type. Let's have a look at what we're actually working with here. So on the back of the card, you can see that we're actually working with 142,000 records. We also report all of the statistics. So that kind of information, what's within my data, it's not just the picture, it's the information that we have sitting behind that. So we can also go in, we can see how we can work with tables and charts. So let's drop the sub-crime type on that. So you see now I can actually pull out multiple pieces of information. We have interactivity between all of the cards. The legends that we work with. So I can actually pick out the different crime types on that map, and you can see that that's reflected.
Okay, I got to ask, how are these correlations being set up? Is it just automatic from what I've imported? Are these fields in that data?
Everything is automatic. So because all of the fields belong to that data, it immediately knows how to work with that. So we can start to pull out information. So let's look at residential burglaries. Do you see how I could just pick that up, grab the residential burglaries, and now I've created a whole new data set that just shows residential burglaries? What I'm going to do is I'm actually going to take that, I'm going to drop that on a different page. We'll come back to that analysis in a bit. So let's get rid of those. You'll see the visualizations that I have. So I brought up these different subcrime types that I have here. You'll see that these cards are actually representing your data. So we can change the visualization type with a simple click. So if I don't want to see that as a bar graph, maybe I want to see it as a tree map. Still got all the interactivity between everything. I can change it to a bubble chart. I can change it to a map. So we're working with everything. This is just your data that you're visualizing. So
quick,
we've
sorry, quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
How would I pull out specific? I mean, you showed me how I can pull out a category and drop it into a new map. But can I draw, say, like pull out three different categories and just compare those against each other? In other words, how do I customize this data based on what I actually want to show?
Okay, so you can actually do selections. You can do multiple selections on the table. So if you want to pull out three different categories. Or, of course, we can go into the data pane itself. So you see as I hover over the field here, I get that option to actually go drill down into that data and do the filtered selections there. So we can pretty much control anything on the data. We can control it on the card as well. So I can go in and I can filter out each one of those features. So you have complete control over the data.
Right.
So we've explored the data a little bit in terms of what we have. But what about over time? So I've got this nice temporal field here. I'm going to drag that across, put it on a chart. And now you'll see it's automatically done the count. So we see the total number of incidents that we have, and we're having that over what I've got here, which is a 2-year period. So now you can see when and where things have occurred across this city. There's quite a lot of points here. What was it I said? 142,000 points. So we can just change that map type. So let's change that to a heat map. Now we can start to explore where there are sort of key centers of crime and how that's actually expanding and contracting over time across the 2 years. So we're seeing this sort of temporal pattern. We're seeing pretty much the same pattern between 2014 and 2015. Fortunately, it's dropped down in 2015, so that's good news. We can see the kind of monthly pattern, but what about the daily pattern? How are things occurring day by day? So when we brought that data in this data, I only have the date field here, but we actually break down that into the different date components that sit within that date. So now let's have a look how crimes change over the day. So do we get more crimes at the weekend? Well, interestingly, no. We see that Mondays have the most amount of crimes. So next time we're all rushing out on a Monday morning after a relaxing day at the weekend, we need to remember to lock our houses because that's the high crime day that we've pulled out here.
I mean, who wants to commit crimes on a Friday? It's a beautiful day. It's the end of the week. You want to relax.
Clearly, we're all relaxed by then, and we're all relaxed at the weekend, especially Sunday.
Linda, we've got a good question from the chat room. Specs wanted to know if, or I know it's possible, but how would I say take congressional districts? Because the last time you were on, we did talk about how this kind of intelligence can actually make sense out of things like an electoral map. And when you start looking at how people voted versus where people actually live, it gives you a better representation of what happened. Well, if I wanted to continue that analysis and actually look at specific parts of the United States by predetermined divisions, how would I do that rather than just saying this is a map?
Okay, let's go ahead and do that. So if you remember, I dragged out the incidents that I was working in. So this is just the burglaries. So I'm going to add in some of those sort of districts, as you were saying. So we actually have census data here from the US. So I'm going to drag in my incidents here, put those on a map, make that a little bit bigger. I'm going to go to that geography and I'm going to drag across those zip codes. So you see now as I dragged across those areas, those polygons, that I get these little drop zones. So I could just add it as a new piece of information, but I'm going to drop it here. So we're going to aggregate up. We're going to count the number of what we have, residential burglaries. And this could be your congressional districts, whatever it is you're actually doing your analysis with. You just zoom back into the map.
Oh, wow.
And you'll see there, that's giving you that pattern. So it's that easy. It's back to the idea that you can just drag things across and work with that data.
That was actually a lot easier than I thought it was going to be.
There you go. You see, anyone can get going with JS. Knowing that we have points, knowing that we have areas, we know that we have the option to just aggregate that piece of information up. So now what we've got is this new result layer that we've got. So I've created in this that count. So that's what it did. It did the count by zip code. So we also got for free the population. We know the population by zip code. So let me take those two variables, put that on a chart, and now we're seeing, are we expecting there to be more burglaries where there are more people? Kind of what you'd expect. Pretty much what we're seeing. It's a good correlation of 0.71. We could see that by zip code. Now we can start to actually see a little bit more information. We're seeing the ones where it is. Absolutely. The more people you have, the more crimes there are. And there's a few little areas here that are off the line. So they're showing that there may be more or less crimes depending on the amount of people. They might be the areas we want to investigate a little bit more. So now we're bringing in the location. We're beginning to understand that different places are behaving differently. So I can actually go into this data and find what the crime rate is. So let me open that data table and do a calculation. So I'm going to do a rate in here and I'm going to find the total number of crimes. Divide that by the total number of population. That's going to give me a new rate. I just need to change that to a rate ratio. Let me drag that over the map, same as I've done before. Now look at what we've got. Now we can see that spatial pattern. We can see where we have high crime rates, and you'll see that that corresponds to those values that we saw outlying on our scatter plot. So now we're seeing that there's a spatial difference. We can understand that it's the crime rate, those areas where we have higher crime than we would expect in other areas. But this is how we would want to understand our neighborhood. We live in zip codes. We all know what zip code we live in. But how is that going to help police chiefs if they're actually looking at manning the people who work within police districts? So they've got a whole different set of boundaries that they want to know the information for. So that's pretty easy. I can just rerun the analysis. You saw how easy it was for me to just drag across those boundaries and aggregate up the number of incidents. But we can go a little bit further than that. Because as I've been doing all of this analysis, everything that I've been doing is actually recorded. So you'll see what I did there is I changed from looking at the page view to the analysis view. And now you'll see that silently in the background, Insights has been creating a model for me. So this is my analysis. This is everything I've been doing. So if I want to rerun this analysis with a different set of boundaries, so the police chief can actually decide how many police officers he wants to put in the right areas, he's going to want to aggregate it up to his areas. So I'm just going to share that as a model. So I'm going to call that model police. Share that back to my enterprise. I'm going to change this to a new page. And I'm going to bring in, just as we brought in our data, you'll see I'll be able to bring in a new model. That same one that I just created. And now all I need to do is update this data. So I want to make sure that I have my incidents data. So now I can update that. But instead of making the zip codes, I'm going to do it to police districts. Now I'm going to update this with my incidents. And you'll see when I update this, that my analysis is going to run. And now you see I've repeated that exact analysis just by running a model. And I have a totally different set of results because I'd already saved that. You can imagine you could be rerunning that analysis with different years of data, different locations. And if we go back, let's take the result that we had there, drag that across, and actually what we had mapped here, you'll see that that rate, if I just sync those two maps together, oops, this is going to test my geography. So you'll see there, totally different maps, all by exactly the same data. You've been seeing I've been working with the same incident data. I've been putting it from one page to the next, how much that spatial location matters. So you can see when I aggregated it to zip codes, I aggregated it to police districts. Now we see the importance of spatial analysis. It affects the patterns. And of course, in this case, it's going to affect how the resources are actually deployed. The police chiefs need a different answer to those of us in the community who actually want to understand the crime in our own areas. So there's one last little challenge I want to throw in here. So if I actually want to look at a particular area of interest, so imagine I'm only interested in, let's say, this northern area. I could just drag that across, drop that on the map, and that's going to filter to that northern area. Now, I'm going to back that up there because you may have just thought, hang on, that map changed. So you see the map now. You'll see the map then. Yes, it did change. We have slightly different colors. The rates are exactly the same. We can get to the information underlying it. We can click on this. You can see those rates. So you can get to that information. But what's happened is the area of interest that we're studying has completely changed. So now I'm just looking at this northern area. I'm seeing the highs and the lows within that sub area. So again, spatial component, very important. Depends on what you're studying, depends on where you're studying things. So I've been working across looking at charts and maps. Another important component we have within this is, of course, the tables. So if I'm going to drag two variables across, you'll see that what the table's actually doing is automatically calculating that depending on the variable that I input. So this is, again, done in the background. If I change this to a different category, you'll see how that dynamically calculated a new piece of information based on the category that I'm dragging across. So that's a very powerful way of getting the information that might be stored in a very large table. So we're looking at over 140,000 records here, but it's quickly updating that information and giving that to me straight away.
This is fantastic.
So hopefully this has shown that geography matters, and it really isn't that difficult. So, you know, we can show the geographical component with Insights for ArcGIS. We can offer an easy way to access any spatial power that your data might actually hold.
You know, this is such an incredibly powerful tool because this does for big data what we have always been hoping to get from big data, and that is correlations that we can actually understand. And when you geographically locate what that big data set is actually affecting, it makes a lot more sense to the people. I do have one question before I bring in my co-host here, and that is live data. This has been asked for in the chat room. Does Esri's tool have the ability to actually take in live data sets? For example, I'm thinking, can I take real-time traffic information that Google puts out, put it together with my big data sets, and actually show, say, crime statistics when traffic is heavy versus when it's light, something like that?
So, yeah, you can bring in data. What we have is the ability to refresh the data. So if I turn one of these cards over, you'll see that it actually reports when the data was last updated. So you can refresh that data set, and that will then refresh the analysis. And remembering how this is all working in one big model, if you refresh your initial data set, then the whole downstream analysis will be refreshed as well.
Love it. It's so easy. Chibert, let me bring you back in here really quickly, because something does occur to me. I love this, because anytime I can take data and make a visualization, I mean, it's cliche, but yeah, a picture's worth 1,000 words, or a picture is worth 1,000 statistics. If I can actually give a map that is based on real-time data, it helps me to get my point across. However, in the chat room, because our chat room, always very wise, always very astute, is saying this is such a powerful tool, it can be misused. CR1 specifically said, look, this could be something that you use to analyze something truthfully, or it could be something that you use to reinforce your own biases. Stepping a tiny bit away from the tool, and this is why I want to ask you, because you work at a university, what's the proper way to use a tool like this? What's the proper way to use a tool using ArcGIS, using this data, without, well, you know, reinforcing the things that you already believe?
Okay, so let me actually do a real live example. The city and county of Honolulu has an ArcGIS database that, through the rules of transparency, laws of transparency within the city and county and state, made tax map keys available. Well, the problem is tax map keys actually have sometimes have some reasonably confidential information on it. So what the city and county did was they actually have exposed only the public layers. So they actually went one step further. They have an internal ArcGIS server, and then they synchronize with a external public ArcGIS server. So real estate agents, property managers, and so forth can still get access to their tax map keys, but not the confidential information, not the confidential layers, and that's kept internal. So that answers one of the questions that people had in the chat room about security. Now, it does go into planning. The city planners use ArcGIS extensively, and the ArcGIS databases in the state of Hawaii are quite extensive. I know Hawaiian Electric, Hawaiian Tel, almost all the utilities are running large ArcGIS databases, and a lot of them are being overlapped at the Department of Emergency Management. California does this also, where a lot of the utility layers are brought in. So at the command centers, like, for instance, Honolulu Fire Department has a system they call hoses. And what it does is, in the city and county of Honolulu, they can actually turn on and off utility layers, so that if they're going to a disaster scene or a large fire, they can actually go and turn on, like, gas lines, electric lines, water, and so forth, and go and find out. They can actually go down and do estimations on what kind of water pressure they can expect at any given time, and overlay that, so they, before they deploy another set of engines, you know, pumper trucks, they'll say, okay, don't use that fire hydrant. Go to this one, because it's on a different so-called circuit, and that way you won't run out of water. You won't be taking water away from the other pumper truck. So there's an amazing number of uses for this. We use that within the university for, like, the Fukushima radiation. We're actually using ArcGIS to map that. Fish migration, coral bleaching, you name it. The university has higher education discounts so that we can get into ArcGIS, and the students are using it fairly extensively. We have cartography that goes crazy with ArcGIS. I used it on some of my DARPA projects for mapping endangered plant species. So there's lots of things that you can do, and it's pretty much limited to only your imagination.
Curtis, let's bring you into this conversation. I mean, I saw you in my preview monitor. We were all staring at the demo screen going, I know where I'm going to use this. What are the features that you think would be most helpful in an enterprise, either from that manager trying to convince his higher up that this needs to happen, or for, say, product placement and advertising placement? Where do you see this kind of intelligence coming into play?
Well, I see this coming into play in a lot of different areas. You know, someone in our chat room mentioned the idea of agriculture, and ag is actually a very data-intensive industry these days, so I can see a lot of potential for ag case uses. The marketing is also critical. I mean, you're looking at how to deploy your resources as a company, where to send your inventory, who's buying what and when. And the thing that I like about it is that it seems that we're getting closer and closer to being able to actually do what are called ad hoc queries. In other words, a manager looks at data set and utters what is probably the most powerful phrase in all of science or business: I wonder if, I wonder if this is related to that. I wonder if this is going on when that other thing is going on. And a tool like this allows you to get answers to things like that without requiring database administrators to go and spend 6 weeks setting up queries, setting up indices. And that actually does bring me to a question I'd love to ask our guests. What sort of connectors exist for pulling data from other databases into the Esri system? Do you have a clear set of APIs that you use, or do you hook into other database APIs to gather the data that you'll then use for your GIS work?
Yeah, so ArcGIS can connect to a myriad of sources of information and bring those right in, whether they're open source based like KML or GeoJSON, or connections into relational data systems or even NoSQL systems like Elastic. So we can work with data across the board using a number of different connector types. We also support a type of database schema known as a geodatabase, and that's one of what I believe Brian was talking about in terms of the ArcGIS database. So we can overlay our capabilities directly inside of things like Oracle or Informix or SQL Server, or we can use those natively and work with those directly. As you know, a lot of these databases have native spatial types, so we can take advantage of those things directly, or connecting directly to a table of information independent of a spatial type, and then geo-enable it on the fly.
Art, we had another good point made in the chat room. I think it was Microhex, who was saying, you know, awesome product, likes the product, likes the demonstration. However, convinced that the best data sets are going to cost you a lot of money, and that's true. I mean, quality data sets will have to pay for, but. I remember the last time you were on, you were mentioning that there are a lot of publicly available data sets that you can mine. What would be your examples of those that someone who just wants to play with the data could use and get usable information without having to shell out a ton of cash?
Well, there's a ton of sites available today called open data sites, and there's a number of companies offering solutions for like government authoritative content from government centers. New York City has a few of those right now, open data sites, Bite of the Apple, things of that nature. And people can glean that information. You can imagine, as a matter of fact, we have this data set from New York, the 311 data set, all the different complaints that people call in and report on. And then you can actually try to mine that information to understand where high outbreaks of health issues are starting to appear just by comparing things like hot water leaks to mold complaints, you know, and then you see a correlation therein, or other types of information that you can get from open source. But yeah, let's also be clear. Data is critically important, but the answers that it provides and or the stories that the data tells are the biggest part of that battle, right? Getting access to data and working with it and figuring out how to get those answers, but making sure that those answers represent the accurate information that you're trying to ask it of is kind of important.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 congressional districts when mapped against crime. I want to thank our guests for being here again. Of course, that's Art Haddad, the CTO, and Linda Beal, a lead project engineer over at Esri. Awesome demonstration. Again, anytime we can see the product, see it at work, yep, we get a much better sense of what it can be used for. And I got to say, this is one of those things. And we had a moment like this last week where we had Kyan come on and show us their Internet of Things platform. This is one of those products that I would just go home and spend hours just tinkering with the data, drilling down, seeing what the correlations are. We're going to have people in the audience who want to play with this. Is there a way for the individual, maybe not even an enterprise, just to get started with this kind of analytics? Where would they go and what could they play with?
Well, over at Esri, we have ArcGIS Online, in which they can sign up for a trial subscription of ArcGIS and work with a set of capabilities in the cloud. They can, obviously, ArcGIS is a SaaS offering as well as a software offering that you can deploy behind your firewall. So contact your Esri representative and work it out. It's really what it comes down to.
Thank you.
Get started today.
Thank you so very much. Again, Art Haddad. Linda, I want to give you the opportunity. You don't have to take it, but is there anything that you want to plug? You did a great job. I want to give you your time.
Oh, no, I was happy to show insights. I hope I've whetted people's appetite for actually using some GIS.
Oh, you definitely whetted mine. Again, Art, Linda, thank you very much for being on This Week in Enterprise Tech. We thank you, and we will see you the next time we have you on.
Take care. Thank you.
Thanks.
And of course, I have to thank my co-hosts. I couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech without them. They are the wind beneath my wings. They are the seat protector on the butt. I'm not going to go down that road. Gentlemen, again, it's always been a pleasure, but please, please plug away. Tell us what you're at, what you're doing, where people can find you. Curtis, let's start with you.
Well, Padre, you can find me over at lightreading.com. I've got some stuff that's going in over there, and we'll have more stuff over the next week because most of my colleagues are going to be in Barcelona covering Mobile World Congress next week. So I'll be here writing about security. Also, to keep up with what I'm doing, feel free to follow me on Twitter, KG4GWA. I try to make it interesting and informative.
And I have to say, I'm very happy that we got you that new camera because if you could switch back to Curtis, in high definition, you are just that much greater. Seriously, you look
Thank
good.
Thank you so you much, Padre.
And Chibert, what's going on over in Honolulu? I know you've got a couple of projects that are cooking. Are any of them ready for you to talk about?
Actually, my third set. I'm doing a series. It's like one a year on enterprise applications for Raspberry Pi. Will probably be appearing on the InfoWorld site. I'm hoping in another week or so. It's in final edits right now and final peer review. So that's kind of cool. That one is actually going to document several of the low to no code IoT solutions, including Kyan. Lots of cool resources, especially LoRaWAN, which is a very, very nice low power but long range radio network. Now, also, everybody, we did an episode number 217, where we talked about ArcGIS plugin for Microsoft Business Intelligence. That is a freebie. Just download. It even works with the free version of Business Intelligence. So if you want to start playing with some BI style GIS data and things like that, have at it. We put the links, I believe, into the show notes. If not, we also put the links into the – yeah, there we go. Put the links in the show itself. Have fun. It's great. And that's actually where the example we did was actually election results. It was very, very interesting stuff. So I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter. And throw show ideas at us. I'd love to go and try and track them down and see if we can get your favorite enterprise solution on the show.
Cheebert, Curtis, thanks again. As always, we'll see you next time. And folks, thanks to you, to the person who drops by HN every single week. Without you, we don't actually have a show. We want to make it easier for you to get your Twiet fix. Like, for example, if you want to see the episode the last time Esri was on, when we talked a little bit about, how their analytics tools could help us break down the vote, you need to go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you're going to find all of our back episodes, as well as where you can subscribe. If you subscribe to our RSS feed, you can get the version of your choice, audio, video, high definition video, into your device of choice. It's the best way to support Twiet and to make sure that you can always get your enterprise goodness here at Twit TV. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on my Twitter account, twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's Padre SJ. There you'll find what I'm doing when I'm not in the Twit TV studios. If you want to see me messing around with the latest Punisher shirt, or see how much I've been geeking out over The Expanse from Sci-Fi that's currently on Amazon.com, or see what I'm doing with my latest know-how project, again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have continued to let us do This Week in Enterprise Tech, to Cheebert, who is our absolutely superb producer, and of course, to the man, the myth, the legend, the Kevin. Kevin, if you get a mic up, could you please tell the audience what it is that you do here at Twit TV?
I look at maps.
Very good. Now, Kevin, you knew this was coming. At the end of every show, we try to give you an opportunity for redemption. We're going to have a very simple question for you. How many, according to ArcGIS, congressional districts are there in the United States?
Oh, 37,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. The answer you were looking for was 435, but we'll try again next week. Kevin, thank you very much for playing. And folks, thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballester, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.